Chapter 18. I decided to get a Spanish visa for Helen at the last town before the border. The crowd outside the consulate was terrifying. I knew the police might already be on the lookout for the car, but I had to take the chance. There was no other way. Georg's passport already had a visa. I drove up slowly. The people began to move only when they saw the German license plates. They made a lane for us. Some of the refugees fled. Through an avenue of hatred, we moved toward the entrance. A gendarme saluted. That hadn't happened to me in a long time. Negligently, I returned the salute and went in. The gendarme stepped aside for me. "You've got to be a murderer," I thought bitterly, "to be treated with respect." I was given Helen's visa the moment I showed my passport. The vice consul looked at my face. He could not see my hands. I had put on the gloves I had found in the car. "A souvenir of the war," I said. "Close combat." He nodded sympathetically. "We too have had our years of struggle. Heil Hitler, a great man, like our Caudillo." I came out. A void had formed around the car. In the back seat sat a frightened boy of 11 or 12. He sat huddled in the corner with his hands over his mouth, and all I could see of his face was the eyes. "We've got to take him with us," said Helen.
"Why?"
"He has papers that expire in 2 days. If they catch him, he'll be sent back to Germany." I felt the sweat on my back under my shirt. Helen looked at me. She was very calm. "We have taken a life," she said to me in English. "It's our duty to save one."
"Let's see your papers," I said to the boy. Without a word, he held out a residence permit. I took it and went back into the consulate. It was very hard for me to go back. The car seemed to be shouting its secret from 100 loudspeakers. Nonchalantly, I told the secretary that I had forgotten about needing another visa, in line of duty, for an identification on the other side of the border. He hesitated when he saw the paper. Then he smiled with an air of complicity and gave me the visa. I got in. The crowd was even more hostile than before. They probably thought I was carrying the boy off to a camp. I left the city, hoping that my luck would hold. The wheel felt sizzling hot in my hands. I thought we might have to abandon the car any minute, but I had no idea what to do then. Helen could not cross the mountains over mule paths in such weather. She was too weak, and loss of the car would be the end of this weird protection by our enemies. Neither of us had a permit to leave France, and that was more important on foot than in an expensive car. We drove on. It was a strange day. Reality seemed to have sunk into an abyss. We drove along a high, narrow ridge beneath low-lying clouds, as in the cabin of a funicular. The closest likeness I could think of was one of those old Chinese ink drawings, showing travelers moving along monotonously amid mountain peaks, clouds, and waterfalls. The boy huddled in the back seat and barely moved. All he had learned in the course of his short life was to distrust everybody and everything. He remembered nothing else. When the guardians of National Socialist culture bashed in his grandfather's skull, he had been 3 years old. He had been 7 when his father was hanged, and 9 when his mother was gassed. A true child of the 20th century. He had somehow escaped from the concentration camp and had crossed the borders by his own resources. If he had been caught, he would have been sent back to the concentration camp and hanged. Now he was trying to get to Lisbon, where he had an uncle, a watchmaker, as his mother had told him the night before she was gassed, when she had given him her blessing and a few last bits of advice. Everything went well. No one on the French border asked for an exit visa. I briefly presented my passport and filled out the blanks for the car. The gendarmes saluted, the gate went up, and we left France. A few minutes later, the Spanish customs guards were admiring the car and asking how many miles it did on a gallon. I told them something or other, and they began to rave about their Hispano Suiza. I told them I had had one and described the emblem on the radiator, a crane in flight. They were delighted. I asked where I could fill up on gas. They had a special supply for friends of Spain. I had no pesetas. They exchanged my francs. We bade each other goodbye with effusive formality. I leaned back. The mountain ridge and the clouds vanished. A strange country lay before us, a country that no longer looked like Europe. We were not yet safe, but it meant a good deal to be out of France. I saw the streets, the donkeys, the people, the costumes, the stony countryside. We were in Africa. This country beyond the Pyrenees, I felt, was the real Occident. Then I saw that Helen was crying. "Now you're where you wanted to be," she said. I didn't know what she meant. I was still too bowled over by the ease with which we had made it. I thought of the politeness, the greetings, the smiles. This hadn't happened to me in years, and I had had to kill in order to be treated like a human being. "Why are you crying?" I asked. "We aren't safe yet. Spain is full of Gestapo agents. We've got to get through as quickly as possible." We slept in a small village. I would have liked to abandon the car somewhere and go on by train, but I decided against it. Spain was unsafe. The quickest mode of travel was the best. In some inexplicable way, the car became a kind of dark mascot. Its technical perfection even dispelled my horror of it. My need of the car made me forget about Georg. He had been a threat hanging over my life too long. Now he was gone, and I felt little more than relief. I thought of the smile. He was still alive, and perhaps he was trying to locate us by telephone. All countries extradite for murder. It had been self-defense, but I would have had to prove that in the city where the crime was committed. We reached the Portuguese border late the following night. I had obtained visas without difficulty on the way. At the border, I left Helen in the car with the engine running. If anything went wrong, she would start up and drive straight at me. I would jump in, and we would break through to the Portuguese side. Nothing much could have happened to us. It was a small station, and before the guards had time to aim and fire in the darkness, we would be gone. What would happen in Portugal was another question. Nothing happened. The uniformed guards stood in the gusty darkness like figures in a Goya painting. They saluted, and we drove to the Portuguese station, where we were admitted just as easily. As we were starting off, one of the guards came running after us, shouting at us to stop. After a moment's hesitation, I complied. If I had gone on, the car could easily have been stopped at the next town. I stopped. We barely breathed. The guard came up. "Your cornet," he said. "You left it on the desk. You'll need it to come back with." "Thank you very much." Behind me, the little boy heaved an enormous sigh of relief. I myself had a sense of weightlessness for a moment. "Now you're in Portugal," I said to the boy. He slowly took his hands away from his mouth and leaned back for the first time. He had been crouched forward during the whole trip. Villages flew by. Dogs barked. The fire of a blacksmith shop glowed in the early morning. The blacksmith was shoeing a white horse. It had stopped raining. I waited for the feeling of release that I had been looking forward to for so long, but it did not come. Helen sat silent beside me. I wanted to be happy, but I felt empty. In Lisbon, I phoned the American consulate in Marseille. I told them what had happened up to the moment when Georg had appeared. The man on the wire said, well, then, I was safe. All I could get out of him was a promise that if a visa were granted, he would forward it to the consulate in Lisbon. The car that had protected us for so long had to be got rid of. Sell it, said Helen. Shouldn't I let it roll into the sea someplace? That won't change anything, she said. You need the money. Sell it. She was right. It was very easy to sell. The purchaser told me he would pay the duty and have the car painted black. He was a dealer. I sold him the car in Georg's name. A week later I saw it with Portuguese plates. There were several like it in Lisbon. I recognized it only by a slight dent in the left fender. I burned Georg's passport. Schwartz looked at his watch. There isn't much more to tell. Once each week I went to the consulate. For a time we stayed at a hotel on the money from the sale of the car. I wanted Helen to enjoy as much comfort as possible. We found a doctor who helped her to get sedatives. I even took her to the casino. I rented a tuxedo for it. Helen still had her evening dress from Paris, and I bought her a pair of golden slippers. I had forgotten her others in Marseille. Do you know the casino? Yes, unfortunately. I was there last night. It was a mistake. I wanted her to play, said Schwartz. She won. She had an incredible streak of luck. She threw out chips at random, and the numbers came. The last days had little connection with reality. It was as though our life at the castle had begun again. We both put on a bit of an act, but for the first time I had the feeling that she belonged entirely to me, although she was slipping away from me by the hour, into the arms of the most ruthless of lovers. She had not yet surrendered to him, but she had stopped fighting. There were nights and nights of torment when she wept, but then came almost unearthly moments when sweetness, sadness, wisdom, and a love without bodily limits attained such an intensity that I scarcely dared to move. My darling, she said to me one night, and it was the only time she ever spoke of it, we won't see your promised land together. I had taken her to the doctor's that afternoon. Now, suddenly, I was overwhelmed by the sense of impotent rebellion that comes to a man who is unable to hold what he loves. Helen, I said in a suffocating voice, what has become of us? She said nothing. Then she shook her head and laughed. We did our best, she said, and that's enough. Then came the day when they told me at the consulate that the unbelievable had happened. Two visas had come. The drunken whim of a chance acquaintance had brought about what no amount of desperate pleas could accomplish. I laughed. It was hysteria. If you're capable of laughing, there's plenty to laugh at in the world today, don't you agree? We've got to stop laughing sometime, I said. The strange part of it is that we laughed a good deal in the last days, Schwartz went on. We seemed to be in a port, sheltered from every wind. The bitterness had run out, there were no tears left, and our grief had become so transparent that it was often indistinguishable from an ironic, melancholy gaiety. We moved into a small apartment. With incredible blindness, I went on with my plan of escape to America. For a long time there were no boats, and then finally a sailing was announced. I sold my last Degas drawing and bought the tickets. I was happy. I thought we were saved. In spite of everything in spite of the doctor. The sailing was postponed for a few days. Then the day before yesterday I went back to the office of the shipping line. The date had been set for today. I told Helen and went out to buy something or other. When I came back, she was dead. All the mirrors in the room were smashed. Her evening dress lay torn on the floor. She was lying beside it. She was not lying on the bed. My first thought was that she had been murdered by a burglar, then that she had been killed by a Gestapo agent, but he would have been after me, not her. It was only when I saw that nothing was damaged apart from the mirrors and the dress that I understood. I remembered the poison I had given her, which she claimed to have lost. I stood and stared, and then I looked for a letter. There was none. There was nothing. She had gone without a word. Can you understand that? Yes, I said. You understand? Yes, I replied. What could she have written? Something. Why? Or... He fell silent. He was probably thinking of last words, of a last token of love, of something that he might have taken with him into his loneliness. He had shorn off a good many conventional ideas, but apparently not this one. If she had once begun, I said, she could never have stopped writing. By not writing, she told you more than she could ever have said in words. He thought it over. Did you see the sign in the travel bureau? He whispered then. Postponed for 24 hours. She would have lived a day longer if she had known. No. She didn't want to go. That's why she did it. I shook my head. She couldn't stand the pain any longer, I said. I can't believe that, he replied. Why should she have done it just when everything was settled for the trip? Or did she think she wouldn't be admitted to America with her sickness? Shouldn't we leave it to a dying woman to decide when she's at the end of her rope? I said. It seems to me that's the least we can do. He stared at me. She held out as long as she possibly could, I said. For your sake, can't you see that? For your sake alone. Once she knew you were saved, she gave up. And what if I hadn't been so blind? What if I hadn't insisted on going to America? Mr. Schwartz, I said, that would not have cured her. He moved his head strangely. She's gone, he whispered. And suddenly, it's as if she had never been. I looked at her, and there was no answer. What have I done? Did I kill her, or did I make her happy? Did she love me, or was I only a crutch that she leaned on when it suited her? I can't find an answer. Must you have one? No, he said. Forgive me. Probably not. There is no answer. There never is, except for the one you give yourself. I've told you the story, he said after a while, because I have to know. What has my life been? Has it been an empty, meaningless life? The life of a useless cuckold, a murderer? I don't know, I said. But if you prefer, it was also the life of a man who loved, or if that appeals to you, of a kind of saint. But what good are names? It was your life. Isn't that enough? It was. But now? It will live as long as you.
It's only we who are keeping it, Schwartz whispered. You and I. There's no one else.
He stared at me.
Don't forget that. Someone has to hold it. It mustn't die. There are only two of us. It's not safe with me, but it mustn't die. It's got to go on living. With you, it's safe.
For all my skepticism, a strange feeling came over me. What did this man want? Did he want to bequeath me his past along with his passport? Was he planning to take his life?
Why should it die with you? I asked.
You will go on living, Mr. Schwartz.
I am not going to kill myself, Schwartz replied calmly. Not when I know that the smile is still alive. But my mind will try to destroy the memory, chew it to bits, reduce it, falsify it, domesticate it, make it into something I can go on living with. Even a few weeks from now, I'd be unable to tell you what I've told you today. That's why I wanted you to listen to me. You won't falsify it, because for you it holds no danger, and somewhere it's got to endure.
Suddenly he was utterly forlorn.
Somebody has to preserve it intact, at least for a while.
He drew two passports from his pocket and set them down in front of me.
Here is Helen's passport, too. The tickets you have already. Now you've got American visas. For two.
A shadowy smile passed over his face and he fell silent. I gaped at the passports. With an enormous effort, I managed to ask, "And you really don't need them anymore?"
You can give me yours in exchange, he said. I'll need it only for a day or two. Just for the border.
I looked at him.
In the Foreign Legion, they don't ask for passports. I don't have to tell you that they accept refugees. And as long as there are barbarians alive like the Smile, it would be a crime to kill myself, to waste a life that could be spent fighting them.
I took my passport from my pocket and gave it to him. Thank you, I said. Thank you with all my heart, Mr. Schwartz.
There's some money, too. I won't need much. Schwartz looked at his watch. Would you do one more thing for me? They'll be coming for her in half an hour. Would you come with me?
Yes. Schwartz paid the check. We went out into the screaming morning. Outside lay the ship, white and restless on the Tagus. I stood in the room beside Schwartz. The mirror frames were still hanging there, empty. The broken glass had been cleared away.
Ought I to have spent the last night with her? Schwartz asked.
You were with her. The woman lay in the coffin, as dead people do. Her face seemed infinitely aloof. Nothing concerned her, neither Schwartz, nor I, nor herself. It was no longer possible to imagine how she had looked. What lay there was a statue, and Schwartz alone had an image of how she was while she breathed. But Schwartz was now convinced that I shared it.
Some letters, he said. Only yesterday.
He took some letters from a drawer.
I haven't read them, he said. Take them.
I took the letters and was going to put them into the coffin. Then I thought better of it. Now, at last, the dead woman belonged to Schwartz alone, or so he believed. Other people's letters had become irrelevant. He didn't want her to take them with her, but on the other hand, he didn't wish to destroy them, because after all, they had been hers. "I'll take them," I said, and put them in my pocket. "They have lost their meaning. They mean less than a small banknote that you spend for a dish of soup." "Crutches," he replied. "I know. She once called them crutches that she needed to go on being true to me. Do you understand that? It's absurd." "No," I said, and then very cautiously, with all the compassion I had, "why can't you at least leave her in peace? She loved you, and she stayed with you as long as she could." He nodded. Suddenly he looked very frail. "That's what I wanted to know," he murmured. It was very hot in the room. The dead woman, the pungent smell, the flies, the spent candles, and the sun outside. Schwartz saw my glance. "A woman helped me," he said. "It's hard in a strange country. The doctor, the police, they took her away. Then last night they brought her back. Autopsy. The cause of death." He gave me a helpless look. Some of her is gone. They told me not to uncover her. The pallbearers came. The coffin was closed. Schwartz seemed to be about to faint. "I'll go with you," I said. It was not very far. The morning was bright and the wind raced like a sheepdog pursuing a flock of fleecy clouds. At the cemetery, Schwartz stood small and forsaken beneath the vast sky. "Do you want to go back to your apartment?" I asked him. "No." He had taken a suitcase with him. "Do you know someone who can fix the passports?" I asked. "Gregorius. He got here last week." We went to see Gregorius. He quickly arranged my passport for Schwartz. There was no need to be too meticulous. Schwartz had on him a card from a recruiting station for the Foreign Legion. He would only have to cross the border. Once at the Legion post, he could throw my passport away. The Legion wasn't interested in the past. "What became of the little boy you brought to Lisbon?" I asked. "His uncle hates him, but the boy is happy. He thinks it's better to be hated by a member of his family than by strangers." I looked at the man who now bore my name. "I wish you the best of luck," I said, taking care not to call him Schwartz. I could think of nothing else to say. "I won't be seeing you again," he said. "It's just as well. I've told you too much to want to see you again." I wasn't so sure of that. It seemed possible that he would want to see me later on for that very reason. I alone, he believed, possessed an unfalsified image of his life. But that could make him hate me. Perhaps he would feel that I had taken his wife from him, this time irrevocably, if he really believed that his own memory deceived him and only mine remained clear. I saw him going down the street, suitcase in hand, a pitiful figure, the eternal cuckold and heroic lover. But had he not possessed the woman he loved more profoundly than all those stupid conquerors? And what do we really possess? Why do we make so much fuss about things which at best are merely lent us for a little while? And why all this talk about degrees of possession, when the illusory word possess means merely to embrace the air? I had a passport photo of my wife on me. In those days you were always needing photographs for identification papers. Gregorius went right to work. I stayed with him. I was afraid to let the two passports out of my sight. By noon they were done. I rushed to the hole we were living in. Ruth was sitting by the window, watching the fishermen's children in the yard. "Did you lose?" she asked when I appeared in the doorway. I held up the passports. "We're leaving tomorrow. We'll have other names, each a different one, and we'll have to get married again in America." I hardly gave a thought to the fact that I was now bearing the passport of a man who might be wanted for murder. We sailed the following afternoon and reached America without difficulty. But the lovers' passports did not bring us luck. Ruth divorced me 6 months later. To make it legal, we had first to get married again. Later, Ruth married the rich American who had given Schwartz his affidavit. The whole thing struck him as too funny for words. He was best man at our second wedding. A week later, we were divorced in Mexico. I spent the rest of the war in America. Strangely enough, I began to take an interest in painting, which previously had meant next to nothing to me, an inheritance, it seemed to me, from the dead and remote original Schwartz. I often thought of the other Schwartz, who was perhaps still alive, and the two of them merged into a hazy ghost, whose presence I sometimes felt. It even seems to influence me, though I know that such notions are pure nonsense. I finally found employment in an art store, and in my room hung several prints of Degas drawings, of which I had grown very fond. I often thought of Helen, whom I had only seen dead, and for a time, when I was living alone, I even dreamed of her. The first night at sea, I had thrown the letters Schwartz had given me overboard without reading them. In one of the envelopes, I felt a small, hard object. I had removed it in the darkness. Later, under the light, I saw that it was a flat piece of amber, in which thousands of years ago, a tiny gnat had been captured and petrified. I had kept it, the death struggle of a gnat, preserved in a cage of golden tears, while its fellows had frozen or been eaten and vanished from the face of the earth. After the war, I went back to Europe. I had some difficulty in establishing my identity, because at that time there were thousands of members of the master race in Germany trying to lose theirs. I gave the Schwartz passport to a Russian who had fled across the border. A new wave of refugees had begun. Heaven only knows what has become of it since. As for Schwartz, I never heard anything more of him. I even went to Osnabrück once and asked about him, though I had forgotten his real name. But the city was in ruins, no one had heard of him, and no one was interested. On the way back to the station, I thought I recognized him. I ran after him, but it was a postal clerk who told me that his name was Janssen and that he had 3 children. The End.